Today is Monday, May 30th, 2011. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good evening. The current time is 5:03, and it's time for a full hour of independent news. Today on CITR News 101, we'll be bringing you coverage of the Site C Dam and an inquiry into the BC Coroner's Office. All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on CITR News 101, your source for independent, local, national, and international news.
But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A Northern Virginia district court ruled in support of legalizing corporate donations today. The ruling is expected to have ramifications throughout the political financing world. FSRN's Brad Kuttner has the story from Richmond.
Corporations and human beings are equally allowed freedom of speech, according to a district judge ruling from a federal bench in Alexandria. This freedom of speech allows corporations to voice their concerns financially just as citizens are. The final decision used precedent from last year's Citizens United case, which allowed corporations to campaign for officials with privately funded advertisements, but still denied direct donations. Today's ruling revoked that ban, giving corporations the right to donate directly to candidates independent of their employees. The ruling stems from a criminal case that accused two men of using corporate funds to reimburse their employees' political contributions to Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2006 and 2008. The courts did recognize limits on campaign contributions by corporations to $5,000 total per candidate. The case is expected to be appealed to the Supreme Court for a final decision. Brad Kuttner, FSRN, Richmond.
Just before midnight last night, President Obama signed a four-year extension of the Patriot Act, the 9/11-era domestic spying authorization. The provisions were set to expire at the end of the day. A few hours before, the U.S. House voted to extend the legislation by a 250 to 153 vote. The Senate passed the bill 72 to 23. Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden, who is on the Senate Intelligence Committee and has access to classified information, argued that the government is abusing the powers laid out in the Patriot Act.
I believe there are two Patriot Acts in America. The first is the text of the law itself, and the second is the government's secret interpretation of what they believe the law means. And as an example, several years ago, Americans woke up to learn that the Bush administration had been secretly claiming for years that warrantless wiretapping was legal. This disclosure greatly undermined the public's trust in the Department of Justice and our national intelligence agencies, and it took Congress and the executive branch years to sort the situation out.
Like many senators, including Tea Party Republican Rand Paul, Colorado Democrat Mark Udall decried the lack of debate on the issue.
The process by which we've considered these provisions has been rushed, and I believe we've done a disservice to the American people by not having a fuller and more open debate about these provisions.
The current extension covers three controversial provisions: warrantless wiretapping, the pursuit of so-called lone wolf operatives, and access to business records. The U.S. Supreme Court yesterday upheld an Arizona law that penalizes businesses that hire undocumented immigrants. The law requires employers to determine citizenship by checking employee social security numbers in the federal E-Verify database. Businesses who repeatedly violate the law could lose their business license. Four states already have similar laws, and 31 others have introduced legislation to do the same. Thousands of people protested today in Egypt's Tahrir Square, pushing the interim military government to move forward on promises of reforms. Some organizers tried to build the protest as the second revolution, but recent efforts have been hampered by threatened fracturing of protest groups. And finally, gay rights organizers in Russia say they will go forward with a planned Moscow Gay Pride parade tomorrow, despite being denied a permit. Police in the city say they will enforce the ban on the parade. GLBT rights groups applied for a permit but were denied by the city government, according to RIA News, because police couldn't guarantee their safety against religious, nationalist, and parents groups who have opposed the action. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Thanks to FSRN for those headlines. You're listening to CITR News 101 in Vancouver. I'm Martin Lemelin.
And I'm Iqbal Ahmed. Now it's time for our CITR News 101 headlines. In campus news, a proposed hospice at UBC will be heading to the UBC Board of Governors, where it will face approval as early as next month. Earlier in the year, the hospice proposal came under fire from nearby residents on the grounds upon which the hospice would be built as the grounds upon which the hospice would be built were close to the promontory, a 94-unit high-rise condominium, which stands nearby the proposed hospice facility. Some residents who were recent immigrants from China drew criticism when they complained about the hospice plan, citing important cultural beliefs regarding debts that would make it impossible to live next to a hospice. In response, UBC held two open houses and worked with an immigration service agency to arrange for residents to attend the alternate palliative care facilities. These efforts, combined with an open feedback process, have resulted in the clearance of the matter to the Board of Governors. However, residents of the promontory are still opposed to the hospice location.
In provincial news, BC's fairly new premier finally got her seat in legislature today. Christy Clark was sworn in as MLA for the Vancouver Point Grey riding this morning. Clark won her seat 3 weeks ago in an outstandingly close contest against BC NDP Representative David Eby. This afternoon, Clark will attend her first question period as Premier, facing off in a much-anticipated verbal bout against provincial NDP leader Adrian Dix. But the two won't have much time to hash out their differences as the legislature adjourns for their summer break on Thursday, June 2nd.
Tomorrow night, UBC will be hosting its very own advanced screening of the Bidu Biodiversity Museum. Titled Raising Big Blue, the Discovery Channel documentary focuses on the blue whale skeleton featured in the Bidu Biodiversity Museum, which is the largest in Canada. The film crew followed the project for 3 years and documented how the skeleton was first revealed during a preliminary dig in PEI. The triumph and setbacks of the excavation and the mystery of the missing flipper that threatened to unhinge the three-year project. The film will show scientists found ways to clean and degrease 20-year-old whale bone saturated with rancid oil, reconstructed a giant skull that had been broken into dozens of pieces, and transported the 85-foot exhibit into the museum's glass atrium. The advanced screening will take place at the BD Biodiversity Museum Tuesday, May 31st, from 10 to 11 a.m., and will premiere on the Discovery Channel on June 5th.
Residents of a fire-ravaged town in northern Alberta are starting to make the long trip home. The people of Slave Lake were given clearance to re-enter their town on Friday. It started with workers who are considered essential to rebuilding the town earlier in the week, and by the 27th, everyone was allowed back to take in the new landscape of their community. Now, cleanup and rebuilding efforts are underway. With one-third of the town virtually destroyed, Slave Lake will never be the same. It'll take months to rebuild the service buildings that were lost to the fire. But first, power and gas crews are working through the town to make sure that the surviving buildings are equipped with heat and electricity. For those who have been left homeless, the municipalities, as well as the government of Alberta, are working on a housing plan. But in the meantime, residents without homes are being encouraged to explore immediate options. like staying with friends, family, or in hotels. A community service center, social center, is in place to help those residents in need. There are still 1,400 emergency and support workers in Slave Lake to help with the recovery phase of this catastrophe. More than half of the homes left now have gas and electricity restored.
A 30-year-old UBC law student is entering the HST battle with a 15-minute video countering arguments made by citizen group Fight HST. The YouTube video titled Fight, Fight HST is styled as a letter to the Fight HST campaign leader Bill Van Der Zarm. Despite the original purpose as a video to educate viewers on the controversial tax, video creator Chris Thompson said that the charge gears which he encountered misleading information on Fight HST website. Said Thompson, quote, "One of the things that drives me nuts is when people spout misinformation or try and make emotional arguments for things that aren't emotional arguments," end quote. The video itself has garnered some controversy, with the provincial Liberals linking the video on their website and anti-HST supporters accusing the video of having been funded and produced by the Liberal Party. However, Thompson has stated that he is not a member of the party. The province is facing the upcoming referendum on the HST, with ballots being mailed out June 13th.
The Postal Union made one last-ditch effort today to quell the fears of a looming strike. The union representing Canada Post workers rejected the Crown Corporation's final offer yesterday, but countered with a compromised version of their initial demands. The union is asking for issues such as excessive workloads and what they consider to be a constant harassing of workers when they are sick or injured to be addressed, as well as regular wage increases. Canada Post says that these demands are simply too expensive and that they'd cost the province, the federal government, $1.5 billion over 4 years. Along with their latest proposition, the union presented Canada Post with a 72-hour strike notice, which means that the post office workers could leave the job as soon as midnight on Thursday. By law, both sides must give 72 hours notice that they're going to strike or lock out, but Canada Post and the union representing its workers have a history of reaching an agreement at the last minute. But if they don't, about 50,000 Canadians will walk out on their jobs.
A newly released UBC psychology study has indicated that women may find men who are proud-looking more attractive than happy-looking men, while men find happy-looking women to be more attractive. In a series of studies conducted by Professor Jessica Tracy and Alec Beale, more than 1,000 men and women were shown hundreds of pictures of men and women smiling, showing pride and being ashamed. The women said that they were more sexually attracted to the men who looked proud and powerful or moody and ashamed, while men put the happy women on top of their list. Beale said studies have long shown women are attracted to more powerful men, which would explain why pride was a factor. However, both were surprised at the unattractiveness of happy men and speculated that smiling men may have unconsciously signaled desperation. Said Beale, quote, It's kind of neat how you can just kind of change your sexual attractiveness by simply switching your emotions, end quote.
And in international news, our Prime Minister made a surprise visit to troops in the Middle East today. Stephen Harper stopped in on Canadian soldiers in Afghanistan after finishing up his duties in France at the G8 summit. Harper's visit comes at a critical time for Canadian involvement in Afghanistan. At the end of July, Canada's role in Afghanistan will transition from a combat mission to a training role, where 950 soldiers will remain in the country to train Afghan military members. During his visit, the Prime Minister took a helicopter tour, discussed mission progress with General Dean Miller, and attended a memorial service to commemorate the 156 Canadian soldiers who have died in Afghanistan. The progress discussed with General Miller included the paving of a road leading into Kandahar City, as well as the conversion of a previously war-torn area known as Ternak Farms, which is now filled with a field of wheat and barley.
In international news, if all goes as planned, in one decade, Germany will no longer rely on nuclear power to produce electricity. Today, in a drastic reversal of policy, German officials announced that it plans to shut down all of the country's nuclear power reactors by 2022. This will make Germany the first major industrialized country to close all of its nuclear plants, but is it a realistic goal? Germany has 17 nuclear reactors, eight of which are already offline. Another six will be shut down by 2021, according to Norbert Rüdingen, Germany's environment minister. The remaining three, the newest in the country, will stay open until 2022 to make sure that power supply isn't disrupted. They're also planning on reducing the country's total electricity consumption by 10%. cutting greenhouse emissions by almost half, as well as expanding the amount of renewable energy by 35%, all within a 10-year span. It's a tall order to fill, but Rottingen confirmed that the plan is definite. The latest end for the last three nuclear power plants is 2022. There will be no cause for revision.
And finally, in national news, the Supreme Court of Canada got a little kinky last week. The highest court in the land decided in a 6-3 split vote that a person cannot give consent to sexual activity performed while one of the participants is unconscious. The case that prompted the decision is an odd one indeed. A man who's being referred to as J.A. was convicted of sexual assault in Ontario. That decision was later overturned by that province's Court of Appeals. The victim, we'll call her K.D., testified at the trial that she consented to being choked into unconsciousness, but didn't expect to have her anus penetrated by a dildo. This case was brought to the Supreme Court last year and centered on whether or not someone could give advance consent to sexual activity that takes place whilst unconscious. KD and JA were a couple and regularly practiced erotic asphyxiation in their sexual escapades, but KD accused JA of assaulting her with a dildo in her posterior when she was unconscious. She didn't file a complaint until a month afterwards when she had an argument with the man. She initially told cops that consent was not given for such an activity, but later admitted that she had indeed given consent. At the initial trial, the judge ruled that someone can't legally consent in advance to sexual activities while unconscious. The Ontario Court of Appeals then overturned that decision, concluding that the lower court had no basis for such a verdict. But finally, last Friday, the Supreme Court of Canada decided that a person must be conscious during sexual activity to give consent. In a minute, we're going to talk to David Eby about a general inquiry into the coroner's office. But first, a word from our sponsors.
You know, Joe, you start with these riffs in your head.
We're good.
And something you want to say, and you want to spin gold. But the thing is, people don't want your sounds. They only want...
You people, you're the fucking coolest!
What is that? What is it? One more shot. A salute.
Tune in to Sore Throats and Clapping Hands, hosted by Robert Privet, Monday evenings at 6:30 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 in Vancouver. I'm Martin Lemlin. I had a chance to speak with David Eby of the BC Civil Liberties Association earlier today about a problem within the coroner's office that it has to do with an amendment made in 2007 regarding whether inquiries into prisoners' deaths should be mandatory or discretionary as to the coroners. So here's that report right now. You may not know about it, but there have been a string of deaths within British Columbian prisons, and nobody seems to know much about it. Four violent deaths, or sudden deaths, in the past 10 months at provincial jails has caused the BCCLA, the BC Civil Liberties Association, to demand that the coroner begin ordering inquests into jail deaths again. Up until 2007, when someone died in prison, a full inquest into the death was mandatory. But in 2007, that rule was amended to allow something called discretionary inquests, which leaves the process up to the coroner as to whether it will be performed or not. On January 14th of this year, at North Fraser pretrial, a prisoner died. Now, the BCCLA was unable to find the prisoner's name or the circumstances of the death in any publicly accessible database or record. And in April of this year, Blair Cody was beaten to death by another prisoner at Fraser Regional. There seems to be an escalation in violence within the penal system. Well, maybe not an escalation, but a definite lack of information. And joining us to speak about that is Executive Director of the BCCLA, David Eby. David, thanks for joining us. So, started off, I guess this whole thing is out. The BC Civil Liberties Association is calling for inquest into prisoners' death, and we got rid of them. There was amendments in 2007. Why did we get rid of the mandatory inquests?
Well, there's a broad trend within how the coroner treats inquests generally in BC, and that's to move away from a situation where inquests are called automatically one where the coroner has discretion, and the discretion is supposed to be exercised in situations where death is going to be overlooked or ignored, which is fine. You know, it's a good idea to have discretion in this office. The problem is that the discretion is not being exercised. And so the issue is, do we hold an inquest every time someone dies of natural causes or appears to die of natural causes in a prison? Or do we give the coroner some discretion? And the problem with the discretionary model is they haven't exercised the discretion in 3 years now.
So there hasn't been a single inquest in 3 years since they've amended the mandatory inquests?
Yeah, in relation to prison deaths.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a sort of weird situation where they have to hold an inquest if the person dies in police custody, and in some of the jails, police are guards. So at RCMP cells or VPD cells. So if you die there, you're going to get an inquest. But if you die at a provincial jail, you're not.
And right now, there are four deaths that were either violent or sudden that happened in BC prisons that we don't know anything about. Is that right?
There's a real information gap around the number of prison deaths. These are four deaths in the last 10 months involving everything from prison violence to drug overdose and to staff error and medicating prisoners. And they're very concerning to us.
Well, what do you think are the consequences of not having any information regarding the deaths that are happening within the walls of our penal facilities?
Well, the consequences are pretty clear to our organization, which is that a systemic issue within the prison, in our opinion, it's overcrowding and understaffing, can go overlooked as a result of not having public inquests. The coroner holds very quiet inquiries. Anytime there's a sudden or unexpected death in a prison, they send in a coroner who interviews people and has a look maybe at the videotape and writes up a report, and then that goes into a file at the coroner's office and it's never seen again. And, you know, if we're lucky, some media outlet will do a Freedom of Information request, or someone will hear about it from a relative, and the story will get out. But if that doesn't happen, then nobody hears about the story at all. So there are actually probably far more than four deaths that have taken place in the last year, and we just don't even know about them because no reporter heard about them one way or the other. So when you don't have the public inquest process, these deaths can easily be missed, and the issues that surround the death, like staffing levels and that kind of thing, won't be addressed.
So the lack of information is actually from, I guess, a lack of interest and probing into the matters from outside sources?
Well, there are two issues. One is that the public nature of the coroner's actions only apply when they do an inquest. An inquest is like a trial where you have four or five jurors, you have a coroner presiding, you have lawyers on both sides calling evidence and witnesses, and you can attend and you can hear it, and then the result, the coroner's verdict, is posted on their website along with recommendations on how to prevent future similar deaths. When you have an inquiry, this is just a paper-based report, so it's not a lack of interest. I mean, our organization is really interested in these deaths. How do we prevent them? How do we ensure safety for prisoners and for staff? But if we don't know about the death, there's just no way that we can get it unless we just schedule regular Freedom of Information requests to them every month or something like that, and hope that the coroner's good enough to send them to us.
What do you think's at the heart of the problem, since they made the inquest discretionary with regards to prison deaths and there hasn't been any? Is it just carelessness with regards to what's going on inside the penal system, or is it too busy, or...?
Well, I think the core issue around the discretion given to the coroner is budgetary. So if you tell the coroner that they only have to hold inquests in certain situations, and there's an indeterminate number of those situations that will come up during the year. So in BC, they must hold an inquest where someone is killed by police or dies in police custody. It's just non-negotiable. So you're a coroner and you're working on your budget. You're like, I don't know how many police deaths there are going to be in the year. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to hold my budget, and I'm not going to hold inquests in these discretionary areas, whether it's prisons or whether it's like Curtis Brick, who died in Grandview Park of heat exhaustion, a homeless guy. You know, I'm just going to hold off on those discretionary decisions, and because I don't want to end up in the red at the end of the year because I've held too many discretionary inquests, and I also held all the mandatory inquests, and there were more than I expected this year. So it's a conservative budget approach that ends up suggesting that the coroner do very few, if any, discretionary inquests.
Did a budget cut come along with the amendments in 2007?
The coroner's budget has been severely restrained, and we saw that when Diane Rothman, who's medical doctor. She was the first non-police officer to be the chief coroner in British Columbia in 30 years. She came into the office, and she worked for about 6 months, 8 months as chief coroner before she resigned. And in her resignation letter, she said that she wasn't being given the resources that she needed to fulfill the statutory mandate of the coroner. And the concern that we have around that, she resigned saying that it would compromise her professional ethics to continue any longer as chief coroner of BC. And that's very concerning, because the coroner's job is to make sure that deaths that are sudden or unexpected are thoroughly investigated and that they're prevented in the future. And if the chief coroner's not able to perform that duty, then that puts everyone at risk, not just prisoners and staff, but also as a result of deaths that take place across British Columbia.
So what can be done to fix it? Do you think it's a matter of reinstating the mandatory inquests?
Well, certainly on the prison front, at this stage, we've lost faith that the coroner will call inquests when they need to be called, will exercise discretion in a way that will ensure that prison deaths and unnecessary deaths are prevented. So unfortunately, we do need to go back to the mandatory death model, which is where everybody who dies in prison gets a full inquest. And I say unfortunately, because really, if the system's working properly, the coroner should be able to look at a death and say, okay, you know what, this was a 70-year-old in the prison, you had a heart attack, due to lifestyle factors, we don't need to hold an inquest here. But clearly the judgment is not working the way that it should. We need to go back to the mandatory model.
How have the discretionary inquest been affecting other areas with regards to death? Like you mentioned, the homeless man who died in the park not long ago.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is beyond just the prison deaths, a coroner's office is very reluctant to hold discretionary inquests anywhere unless, I can't actually tell what the factors are. I was going to say unless X happens, but I don't know what X is. There have been a couple discretionary inquests that have been held, but they're very few and far between. And it's not clear to us what the criteria are that are applied in determining whether or not a death merits an inquest. On the discretionary side. And the reason for that is, and I go back to it, that the coroner is worried that there won't be money at the end of the day. If they hold discretionary inquests, there won't be money to hold the mandatory inquests.
Is it even on the table to reinstate the mandatory inquests? Like, what's the process like from here on in?
No, it's not. I don't think there's any interest in government to expand the sphere of influence or the ability of the coroner to hold more inquests, whether discretionary or mandatory. I just don't think that's on the table. It's not a funding priority. It's not a priority, period. So our hope is that the coroner will step up, and in these deaths that we listed in our press release, for example, the death of Robbie Slatton, Dean Hopkins, that they will actually go in and do these inquests, even though they're discretionary and even though it may jeopardize funding for the mandatory inquest, and then pressure the provincial government to increase resources. The coroner is going to need to show some leadership on this if we're going to get anywhere.
Is there anything else you'd like to add before I let you go?
Only that, we're currently operating in a leadership vacuum at the coroner's office. Diane Rothen resigned now a couple months ago, and there hasn't been a new chief coroner appointed. And our hope is that the person who's appointed is an independent leader and will be able to take the coroner's office where it needs to go. Diane Rothen was certainly that person, but the manner of her disappearing from that office is very concerning. There's also a provincial audit going on. The Auditor General is examining the coroner's office, and we're looking forward to those results as well.
Is there a deadline in appointing a new chief coroner?
No, it took almost a year to get Diane Rothen in place, and there was an acting chief coroner for about a year. Norm Leibel, and he's back acting chief coroner again while we wait, I guess, while a candidate search is done. But with the departure of Diane Rothen and the manner of her departure, I imagine they're having a difficult time recruiting candidates.
All right, well, thanks a lot for joining us, David. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
David Eby is the executive director of the BC Civil Liberties Association and a strong advocate of human rights in Vancouver in general. For CITR News, I'm Martin Lemlin. And back in the newsroom at CITR 101.9 FM, we're now going to go to Iqbal Ahmed for your weekday weather forecast.
Thank you, Martin. Tonight, the For this week, the weather holds. Tonight, cloudy, becoming cloudy period this evening, low of 10. Tuesday, a mix of sun and cloud, becoming cloudy late in the afternoon with 40% chance of showers, high of 19, UV index of 6 or higher. Tuesday night, cloudy, 40% chance of rain early in the evening, periods of rain beginning in the evening, low of 11. Wednesday, periods of rain, high of 16. Thursday, cloudy with 60% chance of showers, low of 10, high of 14. Friday, cloudy with 30% chance of showers, low of 10, high of 17. Saturday, cloudy, low of 11, high of 19. And same on Sunday, cloudy, low of 11, high of 19. So you can look forward to a cloudy and rainy week going ahead. Right. And as always, the weather was brought to you by Environment Canada.
Thank you, Iqbal. We're now going to go to a report regarding a dam that they're thinking about building in northern BC. They've been thinking about building it since 1975. It's a bit of an area of it's an environmental issue as well as a social issue. So the first person we spoke to is Tria Donaldson from the Wilderness Committee, and here is my conversation with her. In 1975, BC Hydro first proposed building a dam at what they called Site C. It's a spot of land near the Peace River Valley, about 18 kilometers upstream from Taylor, and 6.5 kilometers southwest of Fort St. John. Since that initial stride to build a dam, the Site C proposal has been shot down 3 consecutive times, but it's coming up again this year. BC Hydro is now in the environmental assessment stages of trying to build the Site C dam, and we're joined by Tria Donaldson, who's with the Wilderness Committee, to speak to us about the proposed dam site. Hi, Tria. Thank you very much for being with us today. What stage of the assessment process is the Site C dam at right now?
Last week, the provincial government submitted the project description for the Site C dam, which triggers the start of environmental assessment. Over the next couple months, the agencies will be figuring out what is the scope, so what level of intensity and rigor will be applied to the Site C project, and from there it will go to a public comment period, hoping that it will be a full joint panel review with public hearings, which is the strongest form of environmental assessment, but we don't know yet.
Building a dam on Site C is not a new occurrence. They've been trying to get approval to build the site since 1975. How could this debate have lasted nearly 40 years and still not come to a definitive conclusion?
Over the last 30 years, the government's tried to build the dam 3 times, and we've stopped them 3 times before because the project doesn't make sense. The costs to the environment are too severe, and the costs to the public are too steep. And until previous reports from the BC Utilities Commission demanded that before the government move ahead with Site C, that they were able to clearly illustrate that we needed the power and that there was no other alternative. And to this day, they still can't meet that task. They still can't clearly illustrate that the energy for Site C is needed, and they haven't exhausted all of the alternatives.
So this would be the third or the fourth dam built on the Peace River?
It would be the third dam built on the Peace. So the two existing dams, the W.A.C. Bennett Dam and the Peace River Canyon Dam, are existing dams. The thing to remember about that is both of those dams are built in bedrock, which is quite a hardy material, and the soil in the Peace River Valley is actually really unsuitable for dams and very unstable, and frequently there's things like landslides that happen, so there's a lot of concerns about the suitability for the site from an engineering perspective as well.
Mm-hmm. So you say that BC Hydro has had to prove conclusively that the energy demands are there, but that they've failed to do that in the past. So what are the arguments that they have presented?
So they used to have to prove it through the BC Utilities Commission, which had public hearings, and the role of the BC Utilities Commission is to ensure that energy projects that go forward are in the best interest of the ratepayers. Last year, when the government announced the Clean Energy Act, which said they were moving with the Site C dam proposal, government removed the oversight role of the BC Utilities Commission from the Site C dam. So there is no longer an independent party looking at whether or not Site C is the right choice for taxpayers. And previously, it was this body that said no to the dam. So we're really concerned about the fact that government is diminishing and taking away from the regulatory process and taking away the agencies that are supposed to look over the best interests of us, the ratepayer.
So who's overseeing the process this time around?
Well, it's just a regular old environmental assessment, so we don't know what kind of rigor is going to be in place. We don't know who's going to be looking at the file yet. And at the end of the day, it's the Minister of Environment on both the provincial and the federal side that will have the ability to say yes or no to this project.
What do you feel would be the environmental repercussions of building the dam at Site C on the Peace River Valley?
The repercussions of building Site C are going to be huge. It is the number one source of the best agricultural land in northern BC. It's going to flood over 11,000 acres of Class 1 and Class 2 agricultural land, which could feed all of northern BC, the Yukon, and the Northwest Territories fresh vegetables. The Peace River Valley is also a key part of the Yellowstone to Yukon Conservation Corridor, which is a key place for wildlife migratory routes, so connects the northern and south populations of key species like moose, like grizzly bears, like other ungulate species. So it's a really, really important ecosystem, second only in biodiversity to the Okanagan. So it's a really critical habitat, a really unique habitat, both for what it can grow up north. It can grow watermelons, it can grow cantaloupe, it can grow all sorts of things that I can't even grow in Victoria. And it also is home to things like prickly pear cactus, which you think would be in a desert, plus cottonwood trees. It's an absolutely gorgeous place, really, really unique ecosystem, and it will never be replaced if we lose it.
Well, considering all those environmental advantages to the area, what makes the Peace River Valley so appealing to BC Hydro? Aren't there like a plethora of rivers that they could build a dam on?
Well, part of the policy of the provincial government is it's called the Two Rivers Policy. So we can only build big hydroelectric dams on the Columbia and the Peace. So for the last 50 years, Site C has been the site for our next power development. So when we're thinking about why there and why this project, I think it's really important to think of it in the context of the fact that our energy plan right now is a pretty shoddy piece of work, if I can say so. A lot of the modeling about our energy needs are very faulty. Back when they said they were going to do Site C originally, they said if they didn't build it within 5 years, we'd have energy blackouts. Well, we haven't built it. We still don't have energy blackouts. They say we'll have a 40% increase in demand over the 40 years, but at the same time, other studies say we can meet our current demand growth just through conservation. So there's a lot of mixed reports within BC Hydro. There's a lot of questions about the validity of their energy forecasting, and I think we really, really need an independent body like the BCUC, the BC Utilities Commission, to look over this.
When was the last time that there was any serious consideration about building a dam at Site C?
93 was when the project was declared dead by the president of BC Hydro because of the environmental impact and because of the cost being too great to taxpayers in 93.
And the cost has actually gone up since then, hasn't it?
The cost has gone up $2 billion in the last year. And that's just the start. Like, this is a very, very costly project.
So we're in stage three of the decision-making process right now. How long before we'll get to an actual decision-making situation?
The end of the environmental assessment process, which is stage three, would be the decision-making. So that process will probably be about a year and a half.
Right. Is there anything that we may have missed that you'd like to speak about before we let you go?
First off, one of the really important factors to this is the fact that the First Nations, the Treaty 8 First Nations, whose traditional territories this project is on, are dead set against this project. Their people are facing incredible cumulative impacts from the previous two dams that have had a huge impact on the natural landscape up there, as well as oil and gas is having a huge impact on wildlife supplies, on their ability to live out in their traditional ways. One of the things we really need to think about is the consent of First Nations, and Treaty 8 is one of the nations that has a treaty signed, and they feel like this project is in direct contravention to their treaty rights. So that's one really important piece to think about. And the second thing, just to underscore, in all of northern BC, about 60 to 70% of the revenue from this province comes from resource extraction in the Peace River country. And this valley is one of the only untouched places of wilderness left in that area. So it's critical, critical that we protect this and don't allow Site C to go ahead and turn it into a permanent protected area, because it's just really, really important that we keep that link between the north and south parts of the Yellowstone-Yukon chain, and also respect the rights of the indigenous people of that land. So the second thing is, right now, if you're in Vancouver, tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, there is a talk featuring Liz Logan, who's the chief of the Treaty 8 First Nations, Joe Foy of the Wilderness Committee, and two members of the Peace Valley Environmental Association, who will actually have to move and leave their homes if Site C goes ahead. And one of them, Gwen Johansson, has been fighting the project on the Peace for the last 30 years. And they're giving a talk tomorrow at 7 o'clock at Heritage Hall.
Do you have any idea how many people are going to be displaced through their homes if this project goes ahead?
Probably about 200. And a lot of them have been families that have been like, I went up to the Peace this summer and I stayed with Ken and Arlene Boone, third generation farmers on that piece of land. And for the last three generations, they've been fighting hydro projects on their land. And this is the legacy of the valley. There's countless of families who have moved because they're afraid of their future and would like to stay. There's countless more who every day are fighting this project because they don't want to have to leave. And going there and standing in fields rich with crops, knowing that if the BC government has the way, these people's homes and their livelihoods will be flooded. For me, it was one of the most impactful things I've done in my life.
Considering the opposition to the Site C dam has about 40 years of a good track record in keeping the dam out of the Peace River Valley, you think anything is going to be different this time around? It seems odd that BC Hydro would continue to push for the dam when it's been regularly shot down for the past 40 years.
I think this project hasn't made sense from day one and will continue not to make sense, and I really question the viability of going forward with it, and I think the BC government's going to have one heck of a fight based on the last three times they've tried to build it. And I think the people of British Columbia really, this is going to be a huge issue. People should get informed. People should take action, because it's not just impacting the northeast, this one corner. It will impact all of our pocketbooks because it's going to be a massive project, and it's going to have a significant impact across this province.
Well, thanks a lot for taking the time to speak with us. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you for giving me a call.
That was Tria Donaldson, Pacific Coast campaigner for the Wilderness Committee, talking about a proposed dam site called Site C right near the Peace River Valley in northern BC. There's going to be a town hall meeting tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at Heritage Hall, right on the corner of Main Street and West 12th. Anyone's welcome to join the discussion, and it should be a very informative experience regarding the future of hydroelectric power in BC. For CITR News, I'm Martin Lumlin.
Thank you for that report, Martin. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting Student Union Building at UBC. We will bring you part two of that piece right after this quick commercial break, where we will bring you the other side of the story with Dave Conway from BC Hydro. But stay tuned. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC.
Are you interested in radio but not quite sure how to get involved? CITR is the place for you. We are a volunteer-driven campus and community radio station with a variety of volunteer opportunities. Want to become an on-air programmer? Learn about promotions? Maybe become a news or arts reporter? Come learn about all the ways you can become involved at CITR. Volunteer orientations are held on the first Monday of every month at 6:30 p.m. If the first Monday falls on a statutory holiday, the orientation moves to the second Monday. Visit CITR.ca for more information.
Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcast from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. And now we will go to part two of our two-part series on the proposed Site C dam on the Peace River. Now, our contributor, Martin Lemlin, interviewed Dave Conway from BC Hydro, who is pushing for the dam. You heard the opposition before the news break, and now it's time for the other side of the story.
Interested in radio, but not quite sure how to get involved? CITR is the place for you. We are a
Sorry about that. Just a quick technical difficulty. And now, here is Martin Lemlin's interview with Dave Conway.
Continuing our coverage of the Site C hydroelectric dam, I'm joined by Dave Conway with BC Hydro. Hi, Dave. Thanks for joining us. Why would you think that this is an opportune moment for to build the Site C dam?
Well, the Site C Clean Energy Project has been on the books for approximately 30 years, and BC Hydro initiated a review at the direction of the provincial government back in 2007, and that was stage two. And during that period, we reviewed the environmental and technical information related to the project and did extensive consultation with stakeholders, communities, property owners, and First Nations, as well as the province of Alberta and the Northwest Territories. At the end of a stage two project report was provided to the provincial government, and they directed us to move to stage three, which is the environmental and regulatory review stage. So what we have recently done is file a project description report with both the Federal Environmental Assessment Office and the Provincial Environmental Assessment Agency to initiate the formal environmental assessment process.
And that's where we are now.
That's where we are now. That occurred approximately a week and a half ago. What we did as a result of filing the project description report was we had done extensive work on the geotechnical and engineering aspect of the project. We updated an over 30-year-old design for the dam and made some, even though we had a still feasible dam design, the new dam design incorporates seismic safety and environmental features, which incorporate today's standards and guidelines. So you ask about the need. BC has a growing energy demand. That demand is expected to grow between 20 to 40% over the next 20 years. If we break it down on a yearly basis, that's about 1 to 2%. That's quite reasonable. We're seeing growth certainly in the 1.5 to 2% range in the lower mainland and on Vancouver Island. Up in the BC Peace River country is certainly greater than 2%. And in other portions of the province, like the Northwest, it's lower than the 1%. But on average, 1 to 2% is pretty reasonable. We do have periods now where we are importing during peak low demand periods in the year. That's generally the winter time, November, December, January, February. And we can't meet presently our energy demands for peak low during that period. We're actually importing at a high price to meet that low demand during peak hours.
When you do import electricity, where do we get it from?
Well, we get it from the Western Grid, which incorporates Alberta and 13, 14 generating companies in the United States, Washington, Oregon, California, for example.
And how much electricity would the prospective Site C dam produce?
But the new dam design would produce 1,100 megawatts of capacity. This is instantaneous.
Mm-hmm.
And to put that in perspective, our present system has approximately 11,000 megawatts of capacity. 1,000 of that is either gas or it's not integrated. So we've got about 10,300 megawatts of hydroelectric capacity. The Site C project would also produce approximately 5,100 gigawatt hours of electricity each year. So that's the energy over the course of a whole year.
How many homes would that power for a year?
That would be enough homes. That would be enough energy to power approximately 450 homes per year in BC.
Would it be enough to offset or actually make it so that we didn't have to look elsewhere for electricity in those peak seasons you were talking about?
It's part of the picture. It increases our capacity, but BC Hydro actually has quite an extensive approach. A very broad approach to meeting our energy demands with our customers, and BC Hydro has about 95% of the customer base in BC. So first and foremost is energy conservation through programs like PowerSmart at all levels of our customer base, so residential, agricultural, commercial, and industrial. BC Hydro has a comprehensive plan to meet the growing energy demands of British Columbia. First and foremost is energy conservation with our residential, agricultural, commercial, and industrial customers. It's the cheapest way to cover the energy demand, and we're committed to getting 66% of our new load growth through energy conservation. We're also looking at new green, clean alternate energies. So we are and have been since 2002 buying clean energy from independent power producers through micro hydro, wind generation projects, and biomass projects. And we've had ongoing calls since 2002. We're also regenerating our existing facilities like the WAC Bennett Dam and the Peace Canyon Dam up in the Peace River region, but dams like John Hart on Vancouver Island, Ruskin down in the Lower Mainland, and adding additional capacity at Mike and Revelstoke on the Columbia River. So Site C is one option for meeting the growing energy demand.
What is it that you look for in a dam site?
Well, it all depends on what the geography is there. So the reason that this particular dam is an earth-fill dam is because there's not a lot of good, strong bedrock in the area. It's a shales that you would attach the spillway and the powerhouse to. So the earth-fill dam is a short, stubby dam. It's about 1,100 meters across, about 800 meters wide at the base, would come up approximately 60 meters. And it's the short, stubby dam that provides the weight that holds the dam in place. It would create a reservoir that would be 50 meters high, so 150 feet at dam site, and it would then go up river 83 kilometers to the tail race of the Peace Canyon Dam. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, if people think of it as a door wedge, it's thick at the base by the dam and it gets thinner as it goes up towards the existing facility at Peace Canyon. And you can't raise the dam any higher than that or add it any more water, because you would back the water into the tail race and into the Peace Canyon Dam. Would certainly affect the efficiency of the Peace Canyon Dam, but could damage the facility too.
See, at the end of stage three, the environmental process, what would be the next step?
Well, if, and this is a big if, we would require certification from both the Federal Environmental Assessment Office mm-hmm. and the Provincial Environmental Assessment Agency. If we got that certification, we also need to do ongoing consultation and potentially compensate First Nations, and that would be part of certification. If you did all of that, there's a stage four. The government would direct us, their choice, into stage four, which would be final design and procurement. Mm-hmm. And from stage four, then, there's another government decision point, and then that takes us to stage five, which would be a construction phase, and the construction phase would be approximately 7 years. When you put all the timeline together, so approximately 2 years in the environmental assessment stage, and it's not our process, it's the regulator's process, and you do the final design and then construction, you're looking at 2020, 2021 before you would ever have any energy out of the project.
So I suppose that would be why it's so integral to get this thing going right now.
Well, it's the thing about large hydro projects is that they have very long timelines. And to make and to ensure that a project like this remains viable, you continually have to be working towards the different stages and phases. If you're not, and you needed the power tomorrow, you can't do that. It takes, if somebody came along and said, build it, it's still going to take you 7 years to construct. So long timelines. And the other aspect related to large hydro is they have large upfront capital costs. So once you pay off those capital costs, much like buying a home, your cost of buying the home initially are very high, and as you work down the road, in this case, the life of the dam would be over 100 years. As we see with the WAC Bennett Dam, Mike and Revelstoke dams, expensive to begin with, but the energy now and the capacity they provide looks like a pretty good deal.
They've been, it's not a new thing trying to get a dam built at site. See, the BC Hydro's been looking at it for a while. What do you think is going to be different this time around? Are you hopeful that the process will turn in your favor this time?
Well, the as you mentioned, the process and the dam is not new. Certainly from a concept perspective, it's been around since the 50s, and there's been a flood reserve in the area since about the mid-50s. So we've gone through extensive process. The last time it had a full review, I believe, was the late 80s, early 90s. And at that time, the British Columbia Utilities Commission had said that we had not shown, one, need, and two, that we were looking at alternatives. We certainly believe that there is a need, and we are adding alternatives all the time. We're looking, as I said earlier, at a very broad range of meeting the increased load demand for the province. And so we believe that the case for a large hydro project like the Site C project is there.
There is a difference in the process this time around as there was in 1993, though, isn't there? The independent panel has switched somehow.
Well, there's a couple of things. My understanding, and I'm not the regulatory person, but my understanding is that there are a couple of key things. The first is that the actual project need is not reviewable by the British Columbia Utilities Commission. So the Clean Energy Act actually removed oversight by BCUC on the Site C project and a number of other large projects within the province. The second thing is that there's also now the federal and provincial environmental review process with the with the environmental assessment agencies, and so you've got sort of two changes now.
All right. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we let you go?
I think what I would add is that there's extensive opportunity for consultation. We did throughout Stage 2 and will continue throughout Stage 3 to consult with First Nations, and that process will be ongoing. We will also continue to consult with property owners, stakeholders, and communities. There'll be numerous opportunities for consultation throughout the process. We'll go well above and beyond what's prescribed by the environmental assessment agencies. And if people are looking for more information, I would guide them towards our website, and they can locate many, many of the reports that we've done and the background information from Stage 2 and the present work that we're doing in Stage 3. They can find that at www.bchydro.com/Site C.
Well, thanks a lot for speaking with us, Dave. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Martin.
All right, have a good day.
You too. Take care.
That was Dave Conway from BC Hydro. More information regarding the Site C Dam could be found at bchydro.com. I would also like to reiterate the fact that tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at Heritage Hall, the corner of Main Street and West 12th, there will be a town hall meeting to discuss the Site C Dam and the positives and negatives. For CITR News, I'm Martin Lemelin.
Thank you, Martin, for that report. And that's our show for this evening. Thank you for listening.
Go. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us a hot news tip, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email us at news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITRNews. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news,